This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The exclusive GLT podcast, Suspect Convictions, continues. Could new DNA evidence, including touch DNA, exonerate Bart McNeil?
We can have the bed sheet and the pillowcase and the other hairs that were found where Christina was murdered. We can have those tested now.
But is it conclusive? Probably not. Find out why and learn more about DNA evidence in the 1998 murder of Barton McNeil's daughter, Christina. Find out what GLT's culture maven thinks of the latest Star Wars film. It raked in $536 million in the first week. And we asked you to share your family's annual holiday traditions, and you delivered. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's December 22nd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. DNA is the focus of Suspect Convictions this week as Scott Reeder and Willis Kern continue to examine the case of convicted murderer Barton McNeil, who was found guilty of killing his three-year-old daughter, Christina.
The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape, and when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
My daughter is dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. Three-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions with Scott Reeder. I'm Willis Kern. The greatest tool in exonerating the wrongly convicted during the past decade is DNA testing. And defense attorneys contend they have uncovered DNA evidence that points to Barton McNeil's innocence. But prosecutors are saying not so fast. The evidence may not be what it seems. We all remember learning about DNA in school.
DNA is the instruction manual for how to build life. From animals to plants to humans, it defines us all. Information is stored in DNA using four types of molecules, which come in pairs. We have billions of these pairs.
We also remember its role in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Does that mean that these characteristics that Mr. Simpson has, that are also found in the Bundy Walk bloodstain, are only found in approximately one out of 170 million Caucasians or African Americans?
Yes, approximately.
Despite DNA evidence that seemed to point toward guilt, a jury voted to acquit. On the other hand, it has often been used to obtain release for wrongly convicted inmates.
This is history. I became the first person in the United States to be freed by post-conviction DNA testing from a capital conviction, which was death row and double life. I received a full pardon from the governor. I received $300,000 from my trouble. But what puzzled me the worst was who killed Dawn Hamilton.
So, Scott, we hear this term when we talk about DNA in court cases, touch DNA. Exactly what is touch DNA?
It's interesting, Willis. I mean, when you or I or anyone touches a fabric or touches something, a few skin cells will drop away and embed themselves in the fabric. So that's kind of what touch DNA is. It was such a minute amount of genetic material there that up until recent years, it couldn't even be detected. Now, because of the advances in forensic science, they can detect those sort of things. And it's really fascinating, because this was something, of course, they couldn't test for 20 years ago on the bed linens that Christina was on when she died. But they were able to test this last year for the presence of Masuk's DNA as well as Bart's and Christina's on those bed linens. And what they found was kind of interesting.
What role did DNA play in Bart's first trial, if any?
I don't know of any role that it played whatsoever. But you got to remember, 20 years ago, DNA testing was really in its infancy. Now, they did test some hairs that were found on the bed, and they were found to be Christina's, so they weren't particularly probative or exculpatory. In other words, they didn't either point towards innocence or guilt, because you'd expect Christina's hairs to be in her own bed. But now, the Illinois Innocence Project is saying they found Masuk's DNA. And this is what Gwen Jordan had to say about that. She's one of Bart's attorneys.
Since then, we have had so many advances in DNA testing, to the point now where we have what they call low copy or touch DNA. So we can have the bed sheet and the pillowcase and the other hairs that were found on the pillow on the bed where Christina was murdered, we can have those tested now through more advanced DNA testing. And those results indicate that Masuk Nolan was all over the bed sheet, the pillowcase, and her hairs were on the pillow where Christina was found dead.
Martin McNeil says Masuk had not been allowed in the apartment during the final week of Christina's life, and that the sheets were laundered before Christina slept on them that night. So he contends there is no reason why her DNA should have been found on the bed linens.
The lab technician that did the original testing of the sheet, you know, took the evidence, they brought it in, and there were urine stains and some blood stains on the sheet. So the lab technician did a complete analysis of the sheet and wrote on the piece of paper that she of her report that the sheet looked clean and smelled clean, but for these stains. In addition to that, of course, Bart told the police detectives that he had just picked up the sheets from the laundry that day and had, in fact, and has put into evidence the check for the laundromat for that day when he picked up the laundry.
But McLean County prosecutors say this evidence is far from a slam dunk for exoneration. Here's Mary Cole with the McLean County State's Attorney's Office.
How the defense attorneys have phrased that to us is, quote, the DNA testing places Masuk on the bed of the crime scene the night of the murder. Well, that's not an accurate statement, because we're talking about Bart and Masuk, who were in a long-term dating relationship, and according to Bart himself, he had had sexual contact with Masuk as recently as June 13th. So it's certainly reasonable that Masuk's DNA would still be in the residence.
Well, Scott, DNA is supposed to make things so black and white, but it doesn't really seem to be, kind of seems to be mudding up the situation here a little bit. What do you make out of what we just heard?
I didn't realize this until I started doing work on this in podcasts, but there are different types of DNA evidence. For example, let's say I had a cut on my hand, Willis, and I were to shake your hand, and some of the blood were to come off on your palm, and then you were to shake somebody else's hand, maybe a little bit of that blood would transfer over to that person. So in those kind of situations, this DNA can't be transferred around. If you have a medium like blood or hair or semen or other bodily fluids, yeah, DNA can be transferred from person to person. Touch DNA, I'm told, operates a lot differently because you're dealing with such minute amounts of DNA, you know, like just a few skin cells that got released when you were handling fabric. For example, Willis, if you were to touch the sleeve of my shirt right now and I were to go home and my wife were to pick up my shirt, your DNA would not rub off on my wife. It would remain embedded in the shirt. That's just the kind of way it interacts with the environment.
So in essence, it sounds like what you're saying, Scott, is that the more robust the sample, the greater the reliability.
Maybe another way I would put it about it would be, if you have a medium like bodily fluids or hair or something like that that's easily transferable, it moves around. But if you have something like a handful of skin cells to get left behind, they don't really move around the same way. They tend to be static. A lot hinges on whether these sheets were laundered or not laundered, but one of the things that ran through my mind is, okay, Bart dated this woman on and off for 3 years. This is his bed. Let's say he did put fresh sheets on that day on that mattress that he and Masuk had been on many times. Wouldn't you expect to find Masuk's DNA on that fresh sheet? It's on the mattress, I would assume, so why wouldn't it just migrate onto the sheets? And I asked that question of a guy who's a world-renowned expert on forensic DNA. His name's Lawrence Kobolinsky. He's at John Jay College in New York. He's trained many New York City police officers and others. He tends to work with the prosecution and law enforcement more than with defense attorneys. But I asked him that question. Could this explain why Masuk's DNA was found on the sheets? And this is what he had to say.
Where somebody came into contact with that mattress, you wouldn't find DNA on top of the lint. In other words, you would need a direct contact in order to have a transfer of cells from skin onto the object. So they're not going to migrate through the fabric to end up on the other side of the linen.
Kobolinsky says normal laundering with detergent would destroy any DNA on a bedsheet.
Laundering generally will, if it's done right, it will generally clean the garment fairly well. I'm not saying there aren't going to be, you know, micro traces of something left behind, but generally if it goes through that process, you know, I suspect it'll be pretty much clean of DNA.
So with the presence of touch DNA on the sheet, much hinges on when the sheets were last laundered. A technician at the Illinois State Police Crime Lab in Morton, Illinois, noted on her report that the sheets smelled clean. Barton McNeil says he had the bed linens washed before Christina stayed with him that night, and he has presented a receipt from a laundromat showing when he picked up his laundry. But Assistant State Attorney Mary Cole says this hardly is definitive evidence.
He has said through his attorneys that he has proof that he had taken these sheets to the laundromat, and he has produced some type of document. I can't remember if it's a credit card statement or something showing there was a payment to a laundromat, but it's not an itemized bill. So there is no evidence that this sheet was washed.
Such arguments don't sit well with Vanessa Potkin, an attorney specializing in DNA cases for the National Innocence Project, which is not involved in this case.
Somebody else's DNA on sheets, and it really shouldn't be there. I mean, that should be a huge red flag for the state. Instead of doing mental gymnastics to come up with reasons why the laundry couldn't have been washed or there could have been some contamination or mixture, take a step back and say, is this reasonable? Why is this person's DNA on the sheet so next to this young child who was smothered?
But Mary Cole remains skeptical.
My dog died last spring, and right now I have hairs of my dog on my dress. I can see them, and I've certainly washed this many times since last spring. So, I mean, that's just common sense, and that's something that the fact finder, either the judge or the jury, is supposed to employ when they're looking at the evidence. They're supposed to apply their common sense. And I wish that we could have a common sense dialogue about all of this. But if it's going to be phrased as if that hair or the mixtured stain is a smoking gun, then we can't have a reasonable dialogue, because that's simply not the case.
So, Scott, we have some pretty diverse opinions there about how this DNA evidence is viewed. Of course, on the defense side, they're saying that this is a huge red flag, and the prosecutors are saying not so fast. So where are we with this now?
You know, I think we're talking about different things. When I talk to the prosecutors, they talk about the hair and why the hair would be there and how it's not, you know, you could throw a load of laundry in and hair from one person to another could bounce around, and it's not particularly surprising that you'd find Masuk's hair on the sheets, which I agree with, but that doesn't explain the touch DNA of Masuk on the sheets themselves. If it doesn't transfer over, and if DNA is usually destroyed in the laundering process, that really begs the question of, A, when did the sheets get laundered? If, let's say they've been on that bed for a couple of weeks, and Masuk had been on that bed, then it would make sense that her DNA was there. But let's say the answer is that Bart's telling the truth, and he had just put fresh sheets on that bed that day, and Masuk's DNA shows up on that. That's a whole different story. I mean, then you have to ask yourself, How on earth did that DNA get there?
So who do you think does the better job of backing up their case? Because we do have two diverse views of this. The prosecution or the defense do a better job, do you think?
I don't know. Here's what I do know. It's very, very difficult to overturn a conviction. The guy is presumed to be guilty, and they have to show new evidence that would indicate that the jury would have come up to a different conclusion. In this particular case, the judge would have come to a different conclusion. Or they have to be able to show grievous mistakes that were made in the first trial, or something like this. I don't know. When I look at this, I'm thinking, I don't know if this makes it to the threshold or not of compelling enough new evidence to point towards a reason to overturn this conviction. But, you know, just because Bart is presumed guilty does not mean that there's no hope for him in getting released. Vanessa Pokin, an attorney for the Innocence Project, had a pretty good explanation of that, in fact.
Once somebody's convicted, it is true, the burden shifts. Now it's the convicted person's burden to show that they have evidence that is significant enough that it would lead a jury to come to a different verdict. And it's very difficult. Once somebody is convicted, it's extraordinarily difficult to overturn a conviction of somebody who's completely innocent and should have never been convicted in the first place. It's just that the system is stacked against the innocent person after conviction. But that said, there are the burden that a convicted person has to meet to establish their innocence. You know, you don't have to show that it's impossible that you committed the crime. That type of proof almost never exists, and that's not the legal standard. The legal standard is, if a jury heard this evidence, would they probably come to a different verdict?
Potkin says prosecutors likely fear a new trial because it would be more difficult to obtain a conviction because the alternate suspect from the first trial has gone on to murder someone else.
A prosecutor's job is to see that justice is done and not just obtain a conviction. So it shouldn't cause the prosecutors any alarm. They should embrace trying to get to the truth of the case because that really is their constitutional obligation. But if you view your job as one to uphold a conviction at all costs, that would probably be very intimidating and the last thing that you would want to have happen.
But Mary Cole of the prosecution says neither she nor her boss, Jason Chambers, would ever condone prosecuting a case in which they personally believed there was a reasonable doubt of guilt.
We have ethical duties to never proceed on a case where we personally have a reasonable doubt about guilt. So I, of course, believe every single person that I've prosecuted is guilty. But there is always a human element, and I know that there have been convictions that have been overturned. And I know in this office, I mean, I know on cases I've worked in this office, that if I develop a reasonable doubt, my bosses are 100% in support of erring on the side of caution when it comes to incarcerating an innocent person.
And Mary Cole adds that she believes Barton McNeil is guilty. Veteran defense attorney Vanessa Potkin, on the other hand, often finds herself viewing such prosecutorial claims with a jaundiced eye.
I wish that I could say that this is a very unique circumstance, and unfortunately it isn't. We're litigating cases right now where we've found DNA on critical pieces of evidence at the crime scene, and through the code of state bank, they're linked to somebody else who committed a similar crime. And that's exactly the type of case that a prosecutor should walk into court and be willing to join in a motion to vacate the conviction. And unfortunately, sometimes, based on the case, based on the jurisdiction, prosecutors just dig in their heels. And even in the face of science, want to cling to lesser types of reliable evidence.
So, Scott, I ask you again, does it sound like the Innocence Project is set up where they need to be in order to proceed with motions to either free Bart from prison or grant him a new trial?
It depends on who you ask. Some folks are saying this new DNA evidence is a really compelling, and it would indicate that Bart should at least get a new trial. And let's say they do get a new trial. It's going to be a tough sell to a jury, I think, that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt when they present the alternate suspect, Masuk, as somebody who went on to kill somebody else. I mean, people are going to wonder about that. But on the other hand, you're talking about minute traces of DNA. Is it convincing that Bart got the bed linens laundered right before Christina came over. I mean, it's basically a he said, she said sort of situation. I mean, I don't know how you prove something beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened. I mean, he's saying, yeah, I went over to the laundromat and I picked up the laundry. Here's the receipt for it. And I brought it home and put the sheets on the bed. The prosecution saying is, well, yeah, you got a receipt from the laundromat, but maybe you just had your shirts and pants done and nothing else. It's a tough one. We're told to use the word common sense here. Is it common sense that if you were going to have your daughter over at your house that you'd make sure that she was sleeping on clean sheets? Well, if it was one of my daughters, yeah, I would do that. But I can't speak for how Bart would have interacted with his daughter 20-some years ago. For some people, that's a really important thing. Other people, not so much.
So if you're going to rate the level of importance DNA evidence plays in any new trial or a possible exoneration of Bart McNeil, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put the DNA evidence, Scott?
Probably 7. I think that it is interesting at the very least. Is it compelling? I'm not so sure. But it's interesting that they have this new evidence and they're going to be presenting it. And it'll be interesting to see how, when this gets presented before a judge here in McLean County, how that particular judge deals with this new evidence. If he views it as compelling or if he just views it as, you know, somewhat interesting. You really have to show is that there's a high probability that the jury would have come up with a different verdict if they'd only had this evidence. And I don't know the answer to that.
And, of course, another key factor is we're still waiting on the Illinois Innocence Project to file motions in this case, something they've been studying for several years now, but they still have yet to make that leap to actually file a claim in court, right?
Yeah, I talked to Bart, and he's getting very impatient with his lawyers, wanting something filed right away. I talked to one of the attorneys, and he said, you know, we want to make sure this is everything we do is absolutely right and compelling and makes a good case for Bart. And we're not going to get rushed in this process. We're going to make sure that everything is done in the appropriate manner.
Next week during Suspect Convictions, we're back with another roundtable. Scott, this one including a professor and a podcaster. Tell us about it.
Well, we have an interesting couple. We have Amanda Vickery, who is a psychology professor at Illinois Wesleyan University, and probably the ultimate true crime buff. And she's going to be looking at the case. And there's a lot of psychological elements to consider in this case. Is there one of these people that's implicated, a psychopath? You know, what motivates people to be in certain relationships? What's going on? That sort of thing. So she adds a really fresh perspective into the mix. And we also have Carrie Martin from White Wine True Crime, also a big true crime buff, taking a look and discussing the evidence presented in the Barton McNeil case. It's really good to have both of them on Suspect Convictions, to be honest with you, Willis.
That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.
Hear new episodes each Friday on GLT's Sound Ideas and at WGLT.org/suspectconvictions. You can also subscribe to Suspect Convictions on your favorite podcast app. Next week's episode will be a roundtable featuring IWU social psychologist and true crime buff Amanda Vickery and podcaster Carrie Martin with White Wine True Crime. Ahead during Sound Ideas, hear holiday traditions sent in from GLT listeners. That story's ahead. During Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. The latest installment from the Star Wars universe, The Last Jedi, took in $536 million worldwide in a week, opening strong as millions of fans turned out to see the newest film in the popular and influential franchise. Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven, took in the film and shared her thoughts with Laura Kennedy.
Nobody could blame you for being a bit breathless after watching the latest Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi.
We are the spark that'll light the fire that'll burn the First Order down.
Come on!
It is a Star Wars movie, after all. So, of course, we expect it to be whiz-bang, wonderful, and fun. Yes, Sherry Zeck?
No.
What?
No.
It's a Star Wars movie.
Hey, I'm not saying don't go see it. I'm not saying you won't enjoy it, but it's not whiz-bang, wonderful, and fun.
But it's a well-crafted film.
Aristotle would like it because it takes place in a limited amount of time. That's good.
See, you're the first person who's ever talked to me about a Star Wars movie and included Aristotle and what his reaction might be.
Yeah, he'd dig that. This is my general statement about it that doesn't reveal much. It's a little over 2.5 hours, and about 2 hours of that feels like a setup for the next movie.
Okay, but is that a bad thing?
It depends on what's going on in the next movie, I suppose. And I said this to someone the other day, and they said, well, the middle film in a trilogy always feels like that. No, it doesn't have to.
I didn't feel like The Empire Strikes Back felt like that.
No, and I think it's... There was an interest in giving all of these great actors and these great characters serious scenes to be actory and and there are a lot of them. So that took a lot of time.
Okay, I'm going to mention something here that may be a bit cheeky, but do you think that they might actually be thinking Oscars? Because nobody really takes Star Wars very seriously, and nobody's ever won an Oscar except for... Alec Guinness, who won in the first film, A New Hope.
Because he was Alec Guinness.
Because Alec Guinness, exactly. Yeah. Do you think maybe that they're trying to sort of elevate this whiz-bang movie into something that might be worthy of Oscar contention? That type of a film. Not seriously they're going, yeah, we got to get an Oscar for this, but they're trying to elevate it to the Oscar worthiness.
I think some of the actors might be thinking that. I don't think that is... necessarily why their screen time is devoted to these folks and that sort of thing. And I don't think there are any Oscar-worthy performances in this. But Star Wars has always been marked by a philosophic underpinning. I remember being a teenager, and my best friend and I, we thought lightsabers were cool and that kind of stuff, but what we really loved was the notion of the Force. We loved that philosophic thing. It fit in with our teenage MO of wondering, is there something bigger and other? So that philosophic underpinning, which is very much what this film takes on in particular, has always been there. And I think it's more the desire to get at that essential philosophic basis of the Star Wars world that motivates all this time spent building. And it's also always been a character-driven series that now there's a new host of folks. So we got introduced to many of them, not all of them. We got introduced to many of them in the last film. Now they need to give us a little time to like them a little bit more, to be interested in their trajectories as characters.
So let's focus in on one character, and a character that's interested a lot of people since the last film, and I'm talking about Rey, a very self-sufficient, exciting character. So how important is Rey to viewers, particularly female viewers?
I think there is no underestimating the importance of female action heroes particularly to young girls. I think there is a tendency to overestimate a singular figure. So I don't necessarily want to say that Rey, in and of herself as a particular character in a particular film, is going to change the world. But certainly having a female action figure, the central hero of such an important franchise, matters and is important. And when you put that next to Wonder Woman, and when you put that next to the way we are seeing more and more female heroines in action films, the times they are changing, and I think it's very positive in terms of how it feeds the imagination of young women.
Kathleen Kennedy is the producer of this film. She's one of the most successful producers in Hollywood working today. Just how important is that she's a woman? And how important is her impact on character development and ultimately on fans with the work that she does?
Kathleen Kennedy is one of the most powerful people in Hollywood, and in particular because of her attachment to this franchise. also one of the founding persons behind Amblin Entertainment with Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. So she's been involved in the biggest blockbusters of our lifetime. Her importance to the industry is, we can't overestimate that. But one of the ways she has become that important is by not messing around with conventions too very much.
You mean playing the game?
I don't want to say that. I don't know how she works with Lucas. I don't know all that. But she's been powerful for a very long time. And we didn't see a Rey appear 20 years ago. So these films have been extraordinarily popular because they've tapped into our imagination of the future. They've tapped into tropes of good versus evil, of the conflict within the heroes, the conflict within the bad guys, you know, all that stuff. So her films have been wildly successful, in part because they haven't messed around with our sensibilities too much. So this is not like some younger producer like Donna Gilardi, mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm saying her last name right, who was a producer of Shakespeare in Love, which was an unusual take on the Shakespeare story, and then has parlayed her successes into producing Hidden Figures a couple of years ago, or last year, I guess it was. I think we see much more adventurousness or play or pushback to our cultural preconceptions about gender and race coming from producers who are not at the peak of the game, who are not in those super powerful positions. However, I think where you see Kathleen Kennedy's influence in terms of gender is more in the way you see more and more women being hired in her organization and have over time.
So that in and of itself would actually have an impact
long term.
Right. I had you up recently. We talked about the scandals coming out of Hollywood, mm-hmm. Sex scandals, and Harvey Weinstein and company, and everybody's still talking about. And every day there seems to be somebody else mm-hmm. who is being revealed as someone involved in sexual harassment. As viewers, when we go into a movie theater and we're looking up on the screen, we've got this in our head. This is a constant conversation that we're talking about now with how these actresses are being treated. How does this impact how we view the actresses and their characters? Does this impact us as fans?
I hope so. I hope it will be impacting us more and more. I hope that we will start to understand that behaviors that we take as normal and ordinary in life, we're also taking as normal and ordinary in the movies, and we start asking for other things, demanding other representations, just as we demand other things in our daily lives. Fiona Shaw, I don't know if I've mentioned her before. She's a British actress whom I admire a lot. She's in the Harry Potter movies. That's how most people know her. She was asked in an interview if she preferred the term actor or actress. And it's common to just use actor for everybody now. And she said, well, you know, whatever you like. But I prefer actress because I'm a middle-aged woman and there are things I've had to go through in this profession that men have not. And to me, the word actress is not a pejorative. It's not a side point. It recognizes that what I've had to go through is different. And I think that I would hope that is a consciousness that all of this media coverage and all this gossip develops in us as we watch folks on screen. These women, actresses whom we admire, roles that we admire, if we start thinking a little bit about what is perhaps going on behind the scenes for them, we might cut them a little slack. We might hopefully reflect on our own behaviors and how we contribute, what we tolerate in terms of what we see on screen and don't comment on or put to the side. I would hope that there is a change in consciousness.
That's Sherry Zeck, Interim Dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's Culture Maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Zek thinks The Last Jedi will likely be overlooked come Oscar time, but she says there's a possibility that sentiment might gain Carrie Fisher a nomination for Best Actress. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up during Sound Ideas, here are some holiday traditions from Central Illinois GLT listeners. Ryan Denham asked for how you celebrate the holidays, and you responded. The story is on the way. I'm Mike McCurdy. The issue of gun ownership returned to the forefront after mass shootings at a Las Vegas country music festival in October and a Texas church last month. Most of the concerns revolve around restrictions on gun purchases and who can own what type of weapon. Things can get a little murky from a legal standpoint if you happen to inherit a gun from a loved one. IPR's Katie Finland has more.
Final tan and cream case.
Yeah, so I see.
Holly Connell takes out her gun while in her Rockford home and notes the design detail near the gun grip, which has a little carving of a squirrel. She says that's why she and her brothers affectionately referred to the .22 caliber shotgun as the squirrel gun. She says she inherited the gun from her father after he died unexpectedly from surgery complications a few years ago.
You know, it's funny. I don't actually really think of myself as owning a gun. It's really just a keepsake from my father, is what it means to me.
Connell only shot the gun once, just for fun, at a family farm property shortly after her father died. After that, she says, she put a lock on it and stored it.
It was, I think, just more sentimental me to do it, and then I put it away.
Things could have been complicated if Connell had not already had a firearm owner's identification, or FOID card, when she inherited the squirrel gun, especially after her father died unexpectedly.
One day, my husband said, we should get a FOID card. I'm like, cool. And we did. It is really the only reason I own a FOID card. I guess it's my right, so I did it. And so I didn't think anything of it when I received the gun, because I own a FOID card.
There are a few groups of people in Illinois who would not be eligible for a FOID card right off the bat, even if they inherited a firearm. That's according to Mark Jones, director of the National Law Enforcement Partnership to Prevent Gun Violence. He is also a former alcohol, tobacco, and firearms federal agent.
Convicted felons, people who have renounced their citizenship, illegal aliens, drug addicts or abusers, people who have been adjudicated with a mental illness and been involuntarily committed, domestic abusers. There's, I think, 9 categories.
Other categories include being dishonorably discharged from the armed forces or being under a restraining order. That's according to the Illinois State Police Firearms Services Bureau website. Connell says none of those categories applied to her. She says it was fairly easy for her to get the FOID card to begin with and thus take possession of the gun. She says her mother died before her father, so she and her brothers inherited their father's estate.
My dad didn't have a will, and his stuff just came to me. So my dad couldn't transfer the gun to me, hence why I really haven't investigated much further on what to do. I just thought keeping it safe and keeping it put away was my best option.
No matter what type of firearm, as long as it is a functioning firearm and has a proper serial number and so forth, we're only concerned with whether or not the individual has a valid FOID card.
Matt Borwinkle is a master sergeant and public information officer with Illinois State Police. He says anyone with a valid FOID card can possess firearms from a relative's estate, but he still advises gun owners to think ahead when it comes to who actually would inherit the firearm.
One thing we always recommend to persons that own firearms is to have a will and to outline in that will delegate, you know, who is supposed to take responsible possession of the firearm should they pass, and annotate that with make, model, and serial number of the weapon, you know, to be transferred to another individual.
But if a gun is non-functioning and will be used more as a display, Borwinkel says a FOID card might not be necessary for someone who inherits that piece.
So if a firearm is rendered inoperable, you know, the bolt permanently removed or trigger mechanism, whatever the case is, where it becomes permanently inoperable, you know, at that point it's just basically a showpiece. So it really ceases to exist to become a firearm, a functioning firearm at that point.
Borwinkel says one living person who wants to give a gun to another living person as a gift can do so if they submit a transfer notification on the Illinois State Police Firearms Services Bureau website. He says both parties would still need FOID cards. But what if, say, a relative from Illinois dies and a family member from Wisconsin inherits the gun? Former ATF agent Mark Jones says any firearm inheritances that cross state lines are also subject to the other state's laws. I'm Katie Fenlon.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. It's Christmas weekend when families hang their stockings from the chimney with care and leave out some milk and cookies for Santa. But for many families in Bloomington Normal, the holidays aren't so Norman Rockwellian. There are family traditions, old and new, many of them quirky and some of them downright bizarre. GLT's Ryan Denham put a call out to our listeners asking them to share their family's holiday traditions. Ryan, what did you hear?
We heard some really good ones. There were family traditions that stretch back decades. There are others that parents just invented a couple of years ago, but they're kind of quirky and their kids love it. So look forward to playing a few of them for you here in a minute.
When I think of the holidays, I think of the orange we used to get in the bottom of our stockings. I don't know if a lot of people get fruit in their stockings, but this dates back to when my grandparents, during the Great Depression, would get fruit in their stockings, and it was something they really looked forward to because it was something they didn't get a lot of. Of course, I was looking more for candy than citrus fruit.
See, that's not one I've heard of. And for my family, it was all about Christmas Eve. You know, so we'd have me and my brother would sit on my bed, and my parents would come in. We'd read Night Before Christmas. The whole family would watch It's a Wonderful Life together every single year like clockwork.
Can you watch that without getting a tear in your eye at the end of it?
I always fall asleep, so
I've actually seen
the end of it. Yeah,
really?
I'm just kidding. But yeah, that was...
You just ducked my question is what you did. Well, let's hear from some of the families you spoke to. The first one is a good one. It's about a mom and her daughter.
My name is Tracy McCoy, and I live in Normal. And my tradition is my daughter and I go to see White Christmas at the Normal Theater every year. She has three brothers, only girl, so that's kind of our mother and daughter thing that we do together. And we've been going for about 10 years since she was six. And the first time we went to see it, I was worried that she would be bored, but she wasn't. She loved it. Her two takeaways were she liked the fancy cigarettes they smoked, so that wasn't really the takeaway I was going for, but she liked their clothes as well.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
As time progressed, she got really into musical theater. So then she started to really enjoy that aspect. Last year, she was a featured singer in the Normal Community West production of White Christmas. So that kind of was making her dream come true.
To hear sleigh bells in the snow.
And then last year, we were like, oh, you know what? Next year we should do, we should dress kind of like in period, like true to that time period, since she had just come off of doing White Christmas and had kind of dressed like that period as well. So as it got closer to the holiday, I started to look for some costumes for us to be the girls. But those are quite expensive, you know, the blue dresses that they wear when they sing Sisters. So I said, hey, you know what would be really funny if we dressed as the guys? Because we have white shirts and we have black pants, or well, they wear gray pants, but we're going to go with black pants. So I've already ordered my blue fluffy feather fans from, shipped from who knows where, but they got here in time. We're making ourselves some blue sparkly flower headbands like the guys wear. We're going to buy some sock garters to hold up our socks, and we hopefully will be the hit of the White Christmas showing at the Normal Theater. We're actually going to go see it on Christmas Eve this year.
My name is Danny Schroeder, and I'm from Normal, and my family holiday tradition is a Christmas-themed scavenger hunt. Since my four siblings and I are all at least college-aged or older, my mom has come up with this new tradition where she plans out these crazy scavenger hunt clues for us to go around town and do wacky things like finding unique Christmas lights, taking goofy pictures in public places, and even singing with gas station employees, you know, in a few jovial Christmas carols. At the end of the night, once we're done with all of those crazy escapades, we come back to our house and we compare photo and video evidence of everything that we've done. And one of the teams is announced the Christmas scavenger hunt winner. So it's something that we've started to look forward to every year, and it's become a really fun new Christmas tradition for us and our family.
Hello, this is J.T. Payne from Bloomington, Illinois. Our Christmas tradition was started in the 60s by my mother, and we always had to go to Grandma and Grandpa's farm for a big turkey dinner with all the fixings on Christmas Day. So our family decided to celebrate our Christmas at home on Christmas Eve. So we began our festivities with a fondue dinner. Now, fondue is maybe different than the chocolate and the cheese. We cooked steak, chicken, shrimp, poppers, and cheese sticks in hot oil in three fondue pots. And then we also make a bunch of several dipping sauces for each item. And then we also have a delicious pear salad with blue cheese and walnuts, my mother's recipe, as well as a choice of russet or sweet potatoes. Then, after dessert and coffee, we open our gifts. The way we open our gifts is kind of different. We have a Santa picking hat that's worn by the person picking the gift. Now, none of the gifts have names on them, so the picker selects the gift they might think is theirs under the tree. If it's not their gift, the giver says, whose gift is it? And the receiver opens their gift. Then they put on the Santa hat and pick a gift under the tree. And this goes on and on until all the gifts are open. And it's quite challenging because the gift givers have to remember whose gift is whose, which is sometimes very interesting.
My name is Jamie Pollitt, and I live here in Bloomington, Illinois, with my husband, Craig, and then our two daughters, Paige, who is 11, and then our youngest, Emma, who is 9, one in fifth grade and one in third grade. Usually the day of when winter break starts, when school is out, that night usually we go out to eat, and then we'll go on a Christmas light scavenger hunt. What we'll do is usually the girls, they have their clipboards and they have a list. We've done it, I think this will be our fourth or fifth year that we've done it, and they have a list of items that we find just by staying in a car, listening to Christmas music, maybe have some hot chocolate, and just drive around our neighborhood and other neighborhoods that are close and just pretty much all over Bloomington Normal looking for certain props outside that are in front of people's houses. So like a yard with at least 5 reindeer or Disney characters, could be like Star Wars ones, usually that's pretty popular. A decorated mailbox, maybe one of those inflatable snow globes, candy canes or toy soldiers, It's a lot of fun, and then usually every time we end up adding other things that we see, like, oh, that's a good one, you know, so we'll just add it on our list, and then we just kind of make a Word document and print it out for everyone to have it on their clipboard, because they have their clipboard with their little book light attached to it in the car. Simple, but it's fun, and they look forward to it now.
My name is Brian Albertson, and I'm from Bloomington, Illinois. Our family holiday tradition is that the gift notes, of which say, you know, to who the present is to and who it's from, we place those upside down on the present, and we actually tape the edges of that gift tag, because what we do is, when we, you know, gather around the Christmas tree for Christmas presents, we start to distribute, and the first person will pull that off. That person will open the gift, of course, who it's to, and then that person who opened the last gift will then return to the pile to choose a new gift and lift over that tag to find out who that's for. And so that's kind of what that tradition is. The tradition actually started when we were kids. My mom did it because it actually slowed Christmas down. For the first couple of years that we were old enough to know what was going on at Christmas and that was all gifts, is we'd all run downstairs and we would take a look at the gifts, find out which ones are ours, and, you know, take them to, you know, to our own pile. And so it kind of slows the Christmas morning down. We actually had to sit at the top of the stairs until they made sure everything was ready. And my mom would start the coffee and, you know, get the Christmas treats out and make it look like Santa had come. That was a fun part of it. But it really slows it down so that we have time together and we're not rushing through it. But it also adds some fun and spontaneity to it, because there's been times where, you know, my sister or brother will get 5 gifts in a row and I'm thinking, gosh, is there anything under the tree for me? And so it kind of adds some, you know, fun and laughter to it. And, you know, trying to figure out, gosh, who got that big box in the back, or, you know, if there's some obscure bag looking thing, you know, it kind of adds to the mystery of who's getting that gift.
I'm Larissa Armstrong, and I am from Bloomington, Illinois. So ever since I was a kid, Christmas cookies have been sort of a major player in my family's Christmas, and that's just me and my mom and dad, who live in Normal. And so even now, as an adult, I still go over to their house at least one day in December and make these cut-out sugar cookies with my mom. And then my dad actually makes a wide variety of other Christmas cookies that, you know, are part of our whole cookie collection. The recipe that we use is my paternal grandmother's sugar cookie recipe, and they only take 6 minutes to bake, so it's sort of miraculous. We always listen to Christmas music while we make the cookies. My mom and I, our favorite Christmas album is by The Roaches, and it's called We Three Kings, and they are sisters from the New York area. So some of their songs they sing in like a funny, like, Brooklyn accent, and it's really charming. And we were actually introduced to them years ago, like in the 90s, I think, kind of when that album came out even, I'm not exactly sure, when we were visiting my mom's sister and her husband that live in the New York City area, and we actually got to see them in concert over Christmas, and so we've been kind of obsessed ever since. La, 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 la. My dad has told stories about them, him making those cookies with his sisters when they were kids. So I think it's just something that he always enjoyed doing. And then I started doing it with them when I was a kid. And now I just really like doing it. Plus, the cookies are delicious. And so if you want to eat yummy stuff, sometimes you got to make it yourself. La, la, la,
la. That's GLT's Ryan Denham talking with Sound Ideas listeners about their family's holiday traditions. If you want to share yours, go to WGLT's Facebook page and leave us a comment on this story. We'd love to hear yours too. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find this full episode and the individual segments, including the Suspect Convictions podcast. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas and Suspect Convictions. Share your thoughts with a Facebook post at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Mike McCurdy. Happy holidays from all of us at GLT. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.